Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Core Intuition, Pushed to the Brink.
Manton, Manton, Manton. If you want to have a podcast, you have to uphold certain quality standards.
Like I have to do research and be correct about topics or something? I mean, what do you mean?
Now that you say it, actually, no. I think neither one of us will be held to that standard. But we did have something we wanted to share with listeners after our mini rant about the Microsoft Surface vaporware product. We got some feedback from listeners, and it was primarily, Manton, about something you pointed out, which was, I think, a valid criticism of Microsoft's approach in that they are launching with two quite distinct products.
Right. Maybe Windows developers aren't quite as confused as I was, but there's certainly confusion there, and there will be for end users. But as it turns out, what I was saying about Metro apps is not completely true. I mean, you can target both devices. It's just the architecture that's really different. So legacy apps that you don't recompile are not going to work on the RT flavor of Surface. But you can write new apps and target both of them using Metro or not, is my understanding, I think. Does that sound right?
I wasn't listening.
Okay.
No, I was, this was Surface. Well, my final understanding was that there's one device that's Metro only, and there's one device that is Metro plus legacy Windows. Are you saying that there is a, I'm going to be real confused. I'm going to be real, real, real confused if both of these products let you run Metro and old school Windows. I don't think that's the case.
Okay, they can both run Metro,
right?
But only the fatter, bigger, expensive version can run.
That's got to be the case, right? I mean, otherwise it makes no sense at all. I think that must be the conclusion. And if it's not the right conclusion, then listeners can once again correct our misconceptions. But I think I think the point that the listeners who wrote in were making is that it's not such a tormented decision for developers who want to develop Metro apps, right?
Right, right. So, they can target both, right?
And our point is sort of, Microsoft, you just can't leave behind those Windows legacy apps, right? And like Apple's done it and so successfully, and it just seems like they're mimicking some of the right Apple moves, but not all of them.
Right. And speaking of that, as I was looking back on that, one of the right Apple moves is price. I just noticed someone said the low end RT flavor of Microsoft Surface is going to start at $599. Which, I mean, it's only $100 more than the iPad Retina, $200 more, I guess, than the iPad 2 that still sells fairly well, I assume. But do you think that's going to fly? I mean, do you think Microsoft can come in and enter the market with a product that no one's used and
it sure,
at that price?
What does RT mean? You said that a few times. What is that?
That's the thinner, cheaper.
This sounds ridiculous. They're going to come in an underdog with an unproven platform, with a relatively small software selection, admittedly, to some people's tastes, a superior user interface. But coming into a market that's dominated by Apple and then not even meeting the price point, that sounds, let's just say if I was on the team that designed this thing and that built the software for this thing, and then the marketing department or whatever came in and said, okay, well, we can't, you know, maybe it's just a cost thing. Maybe they can't get the parts cheap enough, but they come in and say, we're going to have to charge more than the iPad for this thing. That just sounds like, oh, well, there goes my product. Good luck marketing my product, Microsoft.
Yep.
We probably, the more we talk about Microsoft and the Microsoft Surface, the more incorrect, foolish things we will say. So
I think that's right. And feel free. We got some good feedback on this. And unfortunately, the feedback was a few days ago, and now I've forgotten the exact details, and so I'm going to misspeak again. But happy to hear from more people that are familiar with the platform.
moving on to something we know a little bit more about, let's talk about the Apple App Store some more. Let's talk about it again and again and again until we get blue in the face and pass out.
Or until Apple makes some decisions that we like.
Yeah, right. Well, the latest sort of chilling, I would say, effect to me was the news, not news per se, but the, you know, panic our friends and a company we admire, I think each of us admires quite a bit, the famous Portland, Oregon-based Mac and iOS company, recently had their big Coda 2 launch, you know, Coda 2.0 launched in the App Store right before the sandboxing deadline of June 1st. Mm-hmm. I think everyone's been wondering, oh, well, what's going to happen when they have to try to add new features? And, you know, Coda is sort of notoriously difficult in some ways to sandbox. So they're going to be a great test case for all the things we talk about and all the reasons, you know, you have for wanting to pull Clipstart out of the App Store. And, you know, it turns out it didn't even take them having a major feature update to sort of meet the first test with the App Store, because they came out with their 2.0.1 of Coda, and I think it was just like, you know, weeks, at least a couple weeks.
At least 2 or 3 weeks.
Apparently, Apple was taking their sweet time, or seems like more likely evaluating the app in stricter terms than they had before, because obviously the sandboxing rules are now in effect. Mm-hmm. I took a look at the update list for Coda 2.0.1, and it's
a long list.
It's a long, long list. So it's the list of bug fixes that you see when a company has been working on a major, major new release like 2.0, and then they have all of those, you know, oh gosh, we missed this, or we didn't know about this bug until we shipped it and a bunch more users started using it.
Yeah.
And just all the little stuff, you try to tie up all the loose ends. I bet Apple just saw that huge list and said, no, this is, you want to do all this stuff, you got to be sandboxed.
Yeah. And I wonder if they would have had an easier time and been approved right away if they had just put like bug fixes,
right?
Yeah, which is, hey, you know, we hate that, right? I mean, that's the most frustrating thing as a user, just to see bug fixes. What does that mean? And they have this great comprehensive list. It details all the fixes and improvements and changes they made since 2.0 shipped, and they get burned by it. That's not what you want.
Well, we have to say that's speculative, but
right.
I have to imagine there was some frustration going on because, you know, Stephen Frank from Coda, from Panic he's like the closest to like expressing the frustrations like I do, I think, from mm-hmm. from Panic. He's like, I noticed like Cable, you know, the other co-founder of Panic, sort of like tends to stay pretty guarded, I think, in his speech, and I think Stephen probably does too, but lately it's been kind of interesting for me to follow them on Twitter, because lately Stephen's just been like, oh, you know, to hell with this. And recently, even I think the official Panic account tweeted about plans to have some kind of migration strategy to get people off of the App Store and onto regular licenses.
Right. And it even included a screenshot of a possible migrating tool kind of thing that they were working on, where you would drag Coda into this little window or something, the Mac App Store version, you would drag that in and then it would activate the direct download version or whatnot.
And it's just agonizing to watch, because you've got this great, you know, service, the App Store, and you got this great ecosystem that Apple has built and a community of Mac users who are driven to buy software from the trusted App Store. Mm-hmm. And then you've got these companies. I mean, it just struck me, like, Panic is one of the most beloved Mac companies there is. And they are being driven to imagine migrating out of the App Store, you know? And this is God, this is a wake-up call, you know? If Apple doesn't see this as a symbol of what they're doing with their strategies and their you know, their policies on the App Store, then I don't think they'll ever get it. You know, it's either wake up and see that this is a warning that some of your best developers are being pushed to the brink, or just, you know, shine it on and say, okay, we're going to accept it. This platform is mainly for, you know, Facebook status pop-ups and am I cute or not apps or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
And we don't want that. I mean, there's so many apps that we will lose if it keeps going down this path. And, you talked about Panic has so many beloved customers. I mean, I was going through the comments on one of their posts. I think it was the one where 2.0.1 was still in the queue waiting. And one of the customers posted, you know, thanks for the update. I realize now it was a mistake to buy from the Mac App Store. I asked Apple for a refund and I bought direct so that you get, you know, a bigger chunk of the change and so that I can get updates right away. And these, I mean, these are just end users, right? That are sort of trapped in this situation.
Right.
They shouldn't have to choose. And the fact that some of them are actually actively saying, whoops, the Mac App Store was a mistake. I want to switch over.
Yeah.
It's a real, it's really frustrating. And then the other problem with Coda, right, is that it's got iCloud support now. And so I think Panic is in a tough position because they can't just all out say, everyone go to the direct version. That's the best.
Right.
Because there's a feature that doesn't work.
Yep.
The iCloud syncing stuff won't work.
What really steams me more than I think anything else is when I think about all the time that's being spent on crap, you know, that's not developing new features, that's not focusing on empowering users. You know, the fact that Panic, one of the great Mac software developers, has invested time into a potential tool for migrating users out of the App Store, and that they've had to think about it, and they've had to, and you know, Apple doesn't make this easy either, because Mac App Store receipts have very little information and they're not unique. So you can't just say like, oh, if you have a Mac App Store app, you, you get a license. You know, it's, mm-hmm. it's not that straightforward. So it just forces developers on many, many levels. You know, a lot of developer time has been spent recently, accommodating weird App Store rejections. First of all, strategizing how to balance serving App Store customers and non-App Store customers. And there's just like thing after thing after thing, from the, you know, the basic approval policies for the App Store to the sandboxing requirements coming in, to the feature rift, as you alluded to. So if I'm a developer, I can adopt iCloud for the App Store, but now I've got to put in all this extra time to adopt, you know, Dropbox support or something else if I want to have a similar experience for users outside the App Store. It's just like all these little decisions Apple's making, or maybe more accurately not making, it just really makes me frustrated the extent to which they could smooth over a lot of stuff. And, you know, they have the power to solve problems at the high level that will ease the burden for all developers across the board. Not to say that they don't do that on many levels, but God, some of these outstanding frustrations are really getting to me. And I think the fact that they're getting to companies like Panic as well pretty much sums it up.
All right, this week's episode is sponsored by Smile Software, who makes Text Expander 4, among other things. Text Expander 4 is the latest version of the popular shortcut tool from Smile. The new version features new options for fill-in snippets, which make it easy to create a form letter template that can be personalized with names, dates, and other info when the snippet is expanded. Fill-in snippets are also great for inserting custom links or creating HTML tags with variable attributes. Version 4 requires OS X Lion 10.7. It's $34.95 for a single license, $15 to upgrade, or free if you purchase Text Expander after January 15th. Because Text Expander cannot be sandboxed, version 4 is not available on the Mac App Store. Get it at smilesoftware.com/textexpander.
Text Expander is a wonderful utility. I use it every day, hundreds, I'm sure, well, at least dozens, if not hundreds of times per day. It's really great to have them as our sponsor this week. It's, I promise it was not planned that the sponsor this week would segue with our App Store rant, you know, like Panic's struggle with Coda 2 happened to occur right before this version 4 announcement, and the fact that Text Expander has to go off the App Store is another telling example of what's happening with Apple's App Store policies. But focusing on the positive, you know, I've gotten to use Text Expander 4 now. As I said, I use Text Expander all the time. I use it so much for my customer support and Fog Bugs. You know, Fog Bugs has its own expansion thing, but it just doesn't come close to what Text Expander provides. So it's amazing the kinds of things I streamline with Text Expander that I'm not even using all the features of Text Expander 3, and now Text Expander 4 has like all these insane new options. So basically, Text Expander, the whole notion is you type something, and it causes different text to be inserted into your text editor. But the way that they keep expanding this app is by adding fancier and fancier options to how that text gets generated. So some of the new stuff in Text Expander 4 lets you like have basically prompts come up when you type the shortcut, and you can select from radio buttons or type in custom values. And it's basically like, you know, form mail type stuff.
Yeah. Great tool for developers. I also, on the iOS side, I use their SDK for Text Expander Touch, so that like you can do expansion and tweet library in the text field. That's easy to integrate too, if people ever want to check it out.
So really cool, really powerful. Thanks so much, Text Expander, Smile Software. We appreciate your sponsorship this week. smilesoftware.com/textexpander again.
All right. Well, we have more listener questions. Thanks everyone for writing in. And today we're going to answer one from Luke Hatcher. He writes, I have an app in progress that may end up needing to be sold outside the Mac App Store. It's a common theme today on the show. Of the things that Apple provides that I'd be losing out on, I worry most about having to re-implement my own registration licensing system. With cryptography, it's best not to reinvent the wheel, so I'm hoping there are some established patterns to be employed in attempting to protect my app from thieving ne'er-do-wells. And he also goes on to mention Aquatic Prime, and just wondering what he should do. His app's still in progress. So obviously we both have apps that are sold outside the Mac App Store. We both have our own sort of serial number registration schemes. What do you do? And you've probably had something for a while that's been working well.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about the question is, you know, he mentions cryptography, and I guess my example is that you don't even need to be as complicated or as fancy as cryptography per se. I'll just come out and say it, that there is no cryptography in my licensing scheme. So there's obvious benefits to using cryptography. There's lots of other schemes that basically just involve kind of encoding tricks where you translate the user's key information, something like their name. You perform, you know, whatever manipulations on that data to predictably come up with a license code that can then be reversed to get the original key information. And that's how you validate and check out that the key is good. So that's, you know, something like that is the simple thing that I do. Admittedly, it's not fun. It's not fun to me to like work on that kind of stuff. It's one of those things that actually, you know, speaking of the App Store, it's great that we don't have to do much in that area with the App Store. But the main reason people use cryptographic techniques, something like Aquatic Prime, is that it solves the problem of pirates being able to create serial number generators for your app. Because the cryptographic techniques use, you know, a private key on your server or whatever to generate the license. Only you can actually generate valid licenses that will then check out in the app. Of course, people could crack the app so that the so that the license validation is just like always set to return true or whatever.
Yeah.
But the big advantage is that people can't just wholesale start creating license codes for you, for your app. And I do suffer that to some extent. I don't know how much it costs me. It's the classic question with piracy. How much does it really cost? I don't know. It's always been the question, will those people actually buy a license if they're frustrated enough by their failure to find a pirated code? So I'm not really sure about that. Do you use cryptography in your?
No, my serial number has a glorified checksum on it. It's not very cryptography.
Attention pirates, Manton Reese and Daniel Jalkett invite you to pirate our software.
You know, it's the thing that, you know, I spent a weekend on it. It worked and I'm ready. It's enough for honest people to buy the app so that it's not just absolutely trivial to have it for free. And that's enough. And, you know, before I killed off my WeTransfer app earlier this year, I've been selling it for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, you know?
Yeah.
Stupid serial number system, doesn't work, easy to crack. And, you know, people did crack it and create serial number generators for it. But it was enough for people to buy it. And I really don't think it's worth spending a lot of time on this, especially if your app is also going to be in the Mac App Store. You know, over time, you're probably going to sell more copies in the Mac App Store. You need the direct version just in case you can't get in the Mac App Store, or also to provide discounts and bulk licenses and things like that for people who need them. So you want that, I think, but you don't want to spend weeks on this. I think this off-the-shelf stuff like Aquatic Prime is great. I mean, I know a lot of apps that use that.
Yeah.
No problem with that. I think it's a lot better than trying to build your own.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you build your own thing, you're going to spend either a lot of time on it, or it's not going to be as good as one of these off-the-shelf things.
Yeah, you know, the main downside to me of those cryptographic solutions like Aquatic Prime is the code tends to be quite a bit longer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
the actual code the user has to enter.
Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of it's not a big deal. A lot of people with Aquatic Prime actually just send the code as like an attachment file,
right?
And then they can double-click it and drag it in. But I always kind of liked, it's probably just my old-fashioned, you know, nostalgia, but I liked the sort of idea of having a code that you could just type in by hand from a piece of paper if you need to.
Yep. Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
That was definitely one of the goals for mine, is you could type it in if you couldn't copy and paste it, and you wouldn't make a lot of mistakes, because that stuff introduces more support headaches.
Yeah.
You know, if someone has a weird email attachment that they can't open, or there's this crazy long code that you can't tell the difference between, you know, ones and lowercase L's, or, you know, whatever, you know, that's just creates more work for everybody.
Yeah. And I really like, I find it really charming actually sometimes when you see code systems where they've got, like, instead of random seeming characters, whatever their code system is, it comes up with words instead. Have you seen these?
Oh, yeah.
Like Delicious Library, Delicious Monster does this, and it's kind of cute. You get like the situation where I think if it's possible to add delight to the process of entering a serial code, then they have they have done that just by having, you know, recognizable English words. You know, at least it's delightful for English speakers, I guess.
right.
But, you know, it's
need to localize your serial number scheme.
Right. And so it's like, it's not an area where I think you should spend a lot of time making, you know, adding delight, etc. And as Manton was saying, you know, you could spend a lot of time on this, but I always try to think of it like this. If I spend an hour trying to thwart pirates, you know, further thwart pirates by beefing up my serial codes, or, you know, adding more anti-hacking techniques to my code, would that hour earn me more money adding a new feature or, you know, fixing a bug?
Mm-hmm.
In general, I just like to believe that the cumulative payout of spending my time productively on the app, adding features, fixing bugs, etc., that is cumulatively more powerful and more ultimately even money making than trying to, you know, patch holes in the system.
When you mentioned putting real words in the serial number scheme, that reminded me also, I've seen people put the username in, which is a nice sort of guilt
right.
for sharing, you know? So it's like, if the serial number is like something dash Manton dash right. something, something, then I'm not going to just give it to all my friends, 'cause it's obviously passing around something that's supposed to be,
yeah.
supposed to be just for me. And, I think there's also some tricks you can do now for server activation. People used to hate this. I'm still not sure completely how I feel about it, but if you're worried about people generating their own codes and, you know, having their own serial number generator for your app, but you still want small, short serial numbers,
yeah,
you can activate it when they enter it over the internet. And, you know, you have a little server that verifies that it's not in, that it's actually a valid one. I don't personally do that. I don't know how much trouble it's worth. We were talking about Panic earlier. I know they did that for a while.
I think they do. I think they still do that.
Still do it. Yeah. And it's like I said, a while ago, people really didn't like that, you know?
Yeah.
But nowadays, I think if you do it in a fairly sane way that isn't too user hostile, I think people are okay with it.
Right. And it's the kind of thing where there's always going to be that 0.1% of customers who are kind of outraged and like morally outraged by it. Mm-hmm. But at some point in software development and particularly in software sales, at some point you have to sort of learn to discount the extreme opinions of the very small minority. Right. And that's right. One of the challenges to overcome is you can't have your actions driven by the tiny minority of people who happen to be very vocal about their opinions. Manton, I've been noticing that our iTunes, we got a lot of ratings last time when we asked people to rate on iTunes, so I think we should ask people to do that again. What do you think? Should we do that?
Oh, yeah, yes,
I guess we just
should.
Did. Thanks everybody for that. That really, it's really nice for us to see our star ratings in there, and to, especially when people take the time to write a few thoughts about the podcast. Another thing that we really benefit from is the questions that people continue to send in. Please do that. You can either email us at feedback@coreint.org, or if it's a short enough question and you can really encapsulate it, just tweet it to us at our Twitter account, coreint.
Yep, great, and love to hear from you guys on Twitter or email or whatever. And thanks again for all the reviews, and good talking to you again this week.
Good to talk to you, and I'll see you next week, Manton.
Okay, bye.